This week on What's Going On with Earl Ingram, we're joined by McKinnon Brown of the McKinnon Brown Homeless Sanctuary and Repairers of the Breach. They're on the front lines helping Milwaukee's homeless stay safe this winter, providing warm shelter, hot meals, and vital services. With temperatures dropping, their work is more critical than ever, keeping the city's most vulnerable protected and cared for. Find out all this and tap into the conversation on civicmedia.us or wherever you find your podcasts. And please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss the conversation.
What's going on with Earl Ingram? And boy, do I have a great guest for you this morning. I am thrilled beyond words to be able to have a conversation with an angel. I met this woman, I don't know, 15 years or so ago, and I was at a different radio station at the time, and she was doing some spectacular work in the city of Milwaukee, working with an organization that she founded called Repairers of the Breach. And so Repairers of the Breach was a company or an operation that dealt with homeless people, especially during inclement weather. And if ever there was a time for something like that, it's the winter that we're dealing with today. And so she had done that for a number of years and really kind of built that organization up. And I was enamored with a person who had that charge. And a lot of people may have that charge but don't follow through, but my guest did. And so without any further ado, I want to welcome my good friend, Sister McKinnon Brown, President and CEO of McKinnon Brown's Homeless Sanctuary. Good morning to you, dear sister, and thank you for accepting the invitation.
Good morning. It's my honor. It's my joy. You are one of my dear friends, and God bless you in what you're doing. Happy to support what you're doing this morning. Thank you.
So let me read a couple paragraphs, because I think, you know, without this backdrop, people may not ever get to understand who you are and your commitment. So let's begin by the mission of McKinnon Brown's Homeless Sanctuary: create a daytime sanctuary and multi-resource center for homeless and risk individuals with core values of healing, spirituality, recovery, peer empowerment, dignity, nonviolence advocacy, voice, sustainability, and mutual transformation. This sanctuary is a place to be, belong, and become within a transformational solidarity community, interfaith, nonpartisan, intercultural, and
non-canonical,
and racially and economically diverse family of hope. We seek to strengthen Milwaukee's overwhelmed safety net. Now, Sister McKinnon Brown, President and CEO McKinnon Brown, was born into a family of generational Protestant clergy in central Iowa. She grew up with the example of her faith-filled parents' ministerial commitments. They treated all people with love and respect. Brown attended Ida Bean College, Westerville, Ohio, majoring in music and social studies. She also participated in Black studies and interracial dialogue, did inner city neighborhood work, and attended civil rights events in nearby Columbus during the peak of the civil rights movement. In 1966, after 18 years as a rural homemaker, newspaper reporter, and literary artist in the schools for the Iowa Arts Council, McKinnon Brown moved to Milwaukee in 1991. While participating in the Benedict Institute for Urban Ministry, she vowed to help homeless people and converted to Catholicism. Since that time, she has lived in Milwaukee, Central City and dedicated her life to homeless outreach and advocacy. Brown was invited to be part of the founding group of repairers of the breach in late 1991, became executive director in 1995. Under Brown's 22 years of executive leadership, the needs of thousands of homeless individuals were addressed, creating a comprehensive and effective one-stop shop daytime resource centers, which include a free medical clinic. So I'm gonna stick a pin in it from there, because if I continue to talk about all of the things that you've done, we would not have a chance to have this interview. So, Sister McKinnon Brown, welcome to the Earl Ingram Show.
Thank you.
Let me begin by saying, having known you, you know, angels, people think that angels aren't alive, but there are angels walking amongst us every day. If we just open our eyes and our ears and our hearts and we get a chance to walk with an angel. I've been walking with the angel called Sister McKinnon Brown now for, 14, 15 years. And every time I see you, my spirit is uplifted. You have made a commitment to the lost sheep. Tell us a little bit about why you made this commitment to the lost sheep.
Well, it's hard. I'm a human being, you know.
You're a humble person.
To be called an angel, that's a stretch, you know.
No, listen. You didn't say it. I did, right? And I see you through the prism that I see you. And I don't see many people who have dedicated their entire lives to serving not just some people, but you serve the least. So I'm using the term angel, but go ahead.
As my mother would have told me, just receive that compliment, and especially coming from you, because I put you on a pedestal, and well-deserved, Earl. It appears some people close to me, but also in my looking at the journey, this is a gift that was given to me from my early childhood and just came into more and more evolving and fulfillment. I was raised in Iowa before the influx of Hispanic people in the 80s. Iowa, before that, had very few African Americans, because during the Civil War, Iowa opposed slavery, and it was a farm state, but it opposed slavery and therefore did not have slaves running those farms. So by the time 1945, my birth, it was a very white population there. And so in the little town where my parents were serving a church, when I was 4 years old, I came home from church and we had sung the song, Red and Yellow, Black and White, They Are Precious in His Sight, Jesus Loves the Little Children of the World. And I asked my parents, what does that mean? Does that mean there are children who are different colors than me? And I demanded to know. And they said, well, yes, not here, but yes. And I demanded to see them, and I would not shut up until they took me to Des Moines and showed me people who were different colors than me. And I, looking back, I really think it must have been very deep in me, the sense that there was no diversity where I was, and that I must have longed for diversity way back then. So that's just one example. I do think I had a gift of wanting to be part of what happens in the journeys of African Americans, just as part of it, you know, not as a white savior, not anything like that, but just that I felt part of the Black community, the larger one, the smaller one. Does that make any sense in the world?
It absolutely does. And And because you're a sister, it's not like sisters and the Catholic Church hadn't been in the Black community. They have been in the Black community for a long time. And even in still in some instances still there. I don't know how much of a role that played in it, because you were doing this before you even became a sister. I do understand the calling, and I have a kinship with you in that respect. That is something that we were born with, and we're not the only ones that were born with that, but you know, we've certainly, you and I have certainly listened to the callings that we've had in our lives and pursued it. But let's get to this. So you moved to Milwaukee. Why? How did you wind up in Milwaukee?
I had a new chapter in my life, and I was pursuing the arts. I chose Milwaukee over Kansas City, Detroit, Minneapolis. I chose Milwaukee to continue working in the arts, but God had a plan B, clearly, in 1992, plan B. And there it rolled from there.
Hey, you know, and what you're talking about with plan B is repairs of the breach. How in the world? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about how you wound up in that reality, because, you know, in the 1990s, just so people would have some kind of basis, you know, Milwaukee prior to that was an industrial metropolis, and people lived well in the city of Milwaukee, especially people of color in the 70s and 80s. Milwaukee had one of the highest standard of livings for Black people in the entire nation, because we were a machine shop of the world. We made everything. And so people from the South gravitated here. They couldn't read, they couldn't write, Blacks, but they were able to get these jobs and live the American dream. And so I don't think there was much need in the 70s and the 80s for, you know, what it was that you wound up creating with some support from others. But things changed. And so all of those great jobs and opportunities dried up. And so people began to struggle as industry left our beautiful city, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the nation at that time. One of the cleanest cities. I remember Milwaukee when there was not one crack on the sidewalk or not one dandelion in all the beautiful parks that we had. Industry was here, and it paid the freight to keep Milwaukee looking as beautiful as it was. And so we fast forward to a time where all that's gone, and now struggle started to take place. So let's talk about the homeless sanctuary and how you wound up, not the homeless sanctuary, but the repairs of the breach, and how you wound up being a part of creating that.
Yes. So I had been in Iowa for 2 years. I had been on the staff of a weekly newspaper, an award-winning, you know, very respected. Iowa is mostly small towns, you know,
right,
except for Des Moines. And it's progressive. The Iowa I knew that I knew was progressive. The Iowa that I knew was not a racially prejudiced people. But when I came here for my new chapter, it did get into the grapevine that I had been a newspaper reporter. Once I became part of the Catholic community, I moved into Casa Maria for a while. That's the Catholic worker homeless shelter on 21st. And it got into the grapevine. And here, repairs of the breach, as it began, was a newspaper. It was 6,000 copies were published per year, four times a year, free for homeless people, a resource for homeless people. But the editor was moving to Madison to work on her doctorate. So they were searching for someone to take the job of the editor of that homeless newspaper, Repairs the Breach, and found me. So I came in as editor, and then the person who was president left town, president of the board left town, and all of a sudden I became president of that tiny board, no building, no nothing but a little group, a board of directors for the newspaper. And on that board was Tony Lee, a Vietnam vet who had come back on heroin and homeless, a wonderful man, spiritual revolutionary and poet, who had gotten his life back and became a volunteer. They invited him on the board, and he had the vision of a daytime sanctuary for homeless people. But he told me that other members of the board were not supporting him. Would I support him? So the two of us then co-conceptualized the model that continues today. It's morphed over and over again, small ways, but the basic idea of a place welcoming homeless and at risk and partially run by the very people served. So we began that, and I was president of the board. Then I became executive director. May God rest his soul. Tony Lee was not long with us, but he's declared his belief, his confidence in my ability to lead. If he had not done that, Earl, the going has been rough, but I still remember Tony when I visited him 3 days before his death at the VA. Declared his confidence in me. I still remember that.
You know, Sister Brown, as fate would have it, somewhere along the road, things didn't work out there after you had put in all this work, and you guys parted ways. And tell us a little bit about how that felt.
It was a dark day. It was, you know, a dark moment of the soul, as you say. I parted ways, and I thought maybe I was going to become a greeter at Walmart. But people close to me, especially Dorothy James, had the idea prophetically to create a new organization, partly for my work to continue, but also for the model, the very unique model that Tony and I had co-conceptualized and that had evolved into a splendor there, to continue that model, believing that Milwaukee needed that to happen. We had no concept what would happen with that new organization. We had no financial resources. We had no human resources. They put my name on it. I did not want that, but they overruled me. And we were then in 2014, what we looked like was giving out clothing and food from a parking lot at 20th and Locust. That's what we looked like. So when God closes one door, God opens another one. Don't you know, Earl?
You know, Sister Brown, here's what I would say. You know, you never know. You have to envision something before it becomes a reality. And so you had to have seen this in your spirit and in your mind and in your soul. Because as we move forward with this conversation and fast forward it to where it is right now, You had to envision that. You had to believe. You had to see it in your mind and your heart and your spirit before you could even make this. It's kind of like calling it into existence. And I know it didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen without hard work and sacrifice and beautiful people who have made the McCann and Brown Sanctuary a reservoir of hope. in a desert. And sometimes you go in the desert and you see a mirage, right? And so you think it's an oasis of water. And because you've been in the desert so long and you run and you try to drink from that, what your mind has played tricks on you to believing that it is, in fact, water. And then you get there and it's not there. But that's not what the McCannon Brown Sanctuary is. I remember you inviting me to this place on 24th Street and Center. Is it 24th and Center?
24th Place and Center.
And I remember as a young boy, because I'm a lifelong resident of the city of Milwaukee, when that was a wonderful community. It was owner-occupied homes. It certainly was a middle-class enclave, businesses, people-owned businesses, and safe place to live. But that had long since changed by the time you ventured into that area. But tell me how you found this bomb shelter that that is the Homeless Brown Sanctuary. And let's talk a little bit about that.
5-story building, 35,000 square feet, designed by the famous architects Thomas and Alexander Eschweiler, who built it as a furnace factory in 1927. That's why it's so huge. And then over the decades, different owners, but basically a warehouse. And when I came for a tour at the invitation of the owner, who knew me from repairs of the breach, he said, "This, I want to show you your next sanctuary." And I said, "Yeah, right." And I had a talk with God before I went on that tour, and I talked to me. It's like, don't cave. You know, this is going to take millions of dollars to do the work that's needed. It's a monster of a building. Don't cave. Be nice. So I went on the tour, and I was being nice to my friend Vern, but God spoke to me in that building. God spoke to me. The building was God speaking to me. And I could feel the energy in my bones and in every cell of my body, the energy of hundreds of people doing positive things. And I couldn't deny it. I wanted to deny it. And I was like, no, but I had to admit it. And I got a different group, including the architect Craig Corson, to do a reality check tour. And they all four emerged saying, this is the one. And so we then negotiated. It was hard at first, but miracle was that a wonderful couple who had been with me for years told me they'd prayed about it, gave the money, the $175,000, so we could buy the building. And then after that, it has just been very clear that there's something beyond ourselves that's happened. It's not me. It's something beyond ourselves. I say it's the vision, because it's all in the scripture, Earl. You know, that God in the scripture, and even in the teachings of our brothers and sisters who are Muslim, Sikh, Jewish, Buddhist, etc., that compassion is of God, and that is what we are to be doing for the less fortunate.
You know,
so I hope you're going to talk about what that desert is all about.
We're going to get to that. I don't want to rush it.
But that's how it happens.
I don't want to rush it. So let's be clear. That building, and this is a prime example of vision, envisioning something before it happens. I would look at that building and see a cold slab of concrete with no windows, a five-story building in the middle of a community that was listless and lifeless. And so, and that's what I would have seen had I seen the building from, and I saw it kind of early on when it was that, a cold, listless, concrete metropolis.
Yes, you did. Yes, I mean,
monstrous building that, you know, and that's why I call it a bomb shelter. It would take a nuclear weapon to knock that building down. It is without question one of the most stable buildings. I think that building will stand through several more, at least maybe five more generations. It was so well built, right? I mean, and fortified.
Yes, strong.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
When
so
you broadcast there. When all the lighting that we had was electrical lights on, you know, construction lights.
So you
broadcast out of there.
So you asked me. I came there. I remember in the early stages, and it was you were giving away things, and I was enamored because it was bitterly cold, and you didn't have heat.
Right.
In the building, and we were out back, and it was wide open, and I don't know, it was similar to, it was 10, 15 degrees, mm-hmm. and you were serving, and people were lined up in need, and you had a small army of people with you, and you were feeding the people. Lovest thou me, Peter? Feed my sheep. And that's exactly what you were doing. And so here I am, and I had access, and I was doing radio, and I asked the owner of the radio station if I could broadcast. And at the time, I didn't know that's what was going to be, where we were, and what we and what the weather was. And I got to tell you, I was like, I hope this hurry. I got to hurry up and get out of here. I'm freezing. But the Spirit of the Lord was there, and I never will forget it. And so I really just felt like I've been to many churches and didn't get that feeling, right? But I got that feeling with what you were doing, and it was because you were where? You were right in the heart of where people have been forgotten. Human beings didn't have value because they didn't have money. And they don't have the finer things in life. And we live in a society that bases people's worth on what letters they have behind their names and how many zeros they have in their bank account. But that's not what the McCannon Brown Sanctuary, that's not how you measure people. So let's talk a little bit about how you measure people.
How much light is in their eyes? I notice if they have a light in their eyes. And then I notice if they start having a light in their eyes. And I notice, do they have a light in their eyes most of the time? And they're then giving other people a light in their eyes.
You know, Sister Brown, it is, you're not just talking. You practice this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So when you began this journey to transform this cold building into what it is now, and make no mistake, as wonderful facility as it is, it's not completed yet. But how did when you began this quest with no money, you had you bought the building. You just, is it the faith that you have in and the belief that there's a power greater than yourself that you can do all things? I mean, there are people
all things are possible.
There are people who say that, but they don't practice it or follow through. You have.
And you know, there's that song, God brought us this far, he's not going to leave us, you know.
Yes.
You know that song, Earl?
Absolutely.
You know, yes, yes. But what has been clear and over and over and over and over again, it'd take 10 shows.
I know.
to recap all the different situations that have been where it's clear God has his hand of blessing, not just on what we're doing with the building, but what we're doing
with the people
in our program. And we have almost 30 programs now going, program services initiatives. We just launched an anti-recidivism program that just is going to go over the moon. And that is the zip code that has the highest percentage of incarcerated African-American males in Wisconsin, but in the whole country, Earl. So, you know, to have an anti-recidivism program that people come because we have the credibility, we have the trust of the people coming there. And that is hard earned. That I'm saying, that's hard earned. But when we have it, what an opportunity to walk with people on the journeys.
Mm-hmm. You know, if we talk about all the different programs that you provide, you mentioned 30. I remember, and every time I'm there, I'm looking at people who have been marginalized, who've been forgotten, a cold world. We live in a cold world that looks at other human beings and measures their worth. And it is a horrible indictment of humanity that one human being can look at another human being with disdain because they haven't been able to do what the other person has. And the people who are around you, the souls who are around you, are the ones who haven't been able to navigate our system. There are people who believe, Sister Brown, in this society and in this world, I made it, why can't you? And let's be honest, and I've said it 1,000 times, this is not an easy system to navigate. We need to stop acting like what happens in our country, that everybody should be able to succeed in a capitalistic society. It's not true.
And then as people are forsaken, and we have then the consequences of an entire area of our city with hardly any resources, hardly any retail presence, and no lack of opportunities, the public mind turns to blaming and stereotyping. I'm not talking about people of the various walks of faith. Many of the people of faith don't subscribe to the condemnation, blaming, stereotyping. But what we have here, we are in a desolate area. That's where God put us. I did have a time where people called me crazy behind my back.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
Building. Now they're coming out of the woodwork saying, I was one of them, but now I believe. so goes the journey. But what is true is we have a petri dish. When the industries left that neighborhood, and then the neighborhood went, when they went overseas, those major, you can name them.
Absolutely. I mean, I worked in one for 34 years.
Then the neighborhood went into an economic tailspin, and it is still in a tailspin. And nothing significant was done to reconcile the loss of those industries. So what we end up with is this hyper-segregated area of this city where mainly no retail, very little retail presence. And we can speak on that a little bit more if you wish to. I feel very strongly about that. And the lack of resources, safety net, we are becoming the main safety net for that part of the city, and so needed. But now the closing of six nearby schools, all very close in locale to where we are located, the closing of three nearby supermarkets, the closing of a Family Dollar, et cetera, et cetera. Just what happens when there is that type of petri dish is young people, especially, will not be able to have dreams. They will face very probably either being shot by the age of 21 or end up incarcerated. That's just one example of what happens in this kind of petri dish. Yeah. And we also have then the whole concept of people just checking out. Go ahead, Earl. I want to.
Well, you know, Sister Brown, it's not only the fact that there's no retail, but people who don't have any money, even if there was retail, because the lack of job opportunities that exist in that environment. And so crime is the order of the day, survival. And so generations of children grow up in that desolate place. What you provide in your sanctuary, and whoever termed it sanctuary was a visionary.
Yes.
Because you provide a ray of hope and sunshine to people who can come to you, and they come to you, and you fill almost every need that they can't get elsewhere. And that includes support medically. That includes, loveth thou me, Peter, feed my sheep. You feed the sheep. You feed them not just sustenance, you feed them hope. And the thing that's so wonderful about your sanctuary is people would think, well, number one, I think she's a little nuts, a white woman in an area that's probably almost 100% black, and she's there. And she's got to be out of her mind to be there. But then when you walk inside the sanctuary, there are whites all over inside, from suburban areas, financially well-heeled people serving. How did you make that happen?
It is the vision. It draws people. I do have, I am a people person, but it isn't just about me. We have, and you were there, Earl,
yes,
when the former mayor, Tom Barrett,
yes,
was there to visit at Christmas time. And he says, there's nothing like this anywhere in Milwaukee, because it was so diverse. And we do have the people coming from Oconomowoc, Sun Prairie, Slinger, New Berlin, Grafton, Cedarburg, Brookfield, etc., on a regular basis to volunteer. And their family members are saying, are you crazy? What neighborhood are you going into? But they are devoted. I don't do this alone. But not just that, not just the suburban people. We have the neighborhood people equally involved. Several of them are paid staff. Several of them live 2-3 blocks away, and they are employees helping make that all happen. So when we say we are a transformational solidarity community, the solidarity is all these people of diverse walks of life unified around our vision, and it's transformation. We don't allow someone to come in and fix people. We are against fixing people. We all need fixed. We all need healing. Everybody has areas of their life. So no one's coming in there with an arrogance that they're going to fix anybody. We all are all joined together in a unity around the compassionate work that we're doing. We do offer programs and services, but it's in a spirit of community. We're an actual community, Earl.
Talk about those people from those areas that of this of the city and surrounding the suburbs of the city of Milwaukee who would normally not ever venture into the city of Milwaukee, but they come there. But they come there just like the people from the community who come there to be fed. Those people from those other areas come there to be fed a different kind of bread,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Amen.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, there's different
They're
kinds
hungry.
Of bread. Yes.
They're hungry. If we really could do a CAT scan of everybody's spirit in America, everyone has a hunger for what we're doing there. Everyone has a hunger for a diverse community that is transformational in its spirit. And I think when I was 4 years old, there was something, I was tuning into that because I knew something was missing in my world. And I think that's true for every human being. What do you think?
Absolutely. You and I are spiritually connected. Yeah. About a year and a half ago, I don't know, maybe it's 2 years now, a friend of mine called me up and said, hey, I got a buddy who's looking to give away some money. And he said, do you know a place? He's talking to me. He said, do you know a place that he can donate some money? And I said, yeah, I do know. I know right away. I called Sister McCannon Brown. And I said, well, Sister McCannon Brown, I got a guy who wants to donate some money. I'm expecting a couple $1,000s, right? And so we connect, and I call Sister Brown, and the guy says, I'm going to meet you over there. And I said, okay. So I took him over to the sanctuary, and you take us on a tour.
Yeah.
And this guy certainly looked non-assuming, right? He just looked like an average everyday Joe, right?
Yeah.
And so we walk around for about 15 minutes. He sees the operation. And he said to me, hey, Earl, where's an office? Is there an office somewhere? So after he was fed his bread that he was looking for, he said, let's go sit down in the office. I sit down in the office with him and Sister Brown. And he pulls out his personal checkbook.
I remember that.
And I'm expecting him to, you know, write about a $2,000 or $3,000 check. And he wrote the check and he handed it to me. And I looked at it and I almost fainted.
Yes.
It was $30,000.
Yes.
And he donated on the spot $30,000. And before I could
15-minute tour.
Yes.
Right?
And before I could come to, he added these words, in perpetuity. And so he's so enamored with the work that you do, he's donating $30,000 a year to your program as long as he's alive.
Yeah.
He's not the only person donating to you. There are people who believe in your program, the support that you get is enormous.
Thank you for that. And There's no fluff in our organization. We are very careful stewards, but more than that, we are not money driven. We're vision driven and faith driven. And that's how I think the money comes, because we're not money driven. It becomes that we are a living manifestation of a vision that's meant to be, and the faith of hundreds of people helping make that happen who believe in that vision.
Now I've been doing a segment on my show, on my radio show called Get the Lead Out. And yes. And I've got people from specialists from all over this country who I have as guests as we prepare to continue to fight the battle that has to be fought and won in this country, where children are being poisoned by lead in the water, not just in urban areas, in rural areas. And so you invited me again, another time you invited me and I showed up. And how did you get connected with testing the children for lead?
We paid attention to the work of the Lead Coalition. And
Robert Miranda, my good friend. On it.
Then we decided, because we found out that we are in the most lead-contaminated neighborhood in Milwaukee, that we started our own program, had it going well. And Children's Hospital approached us and asked, could they come on site on a regular basis and do lead testing? Because they saw we have the credibility. The people come. The people trust coming in our door. The people we serve, you know, are not trusting of vaccines. They're not trusting, you know, because of the Tuskegee, right, you know, situation. They're not trusting a lot of times, but they will come. And we've tested over 200 children and teens. Found, you know, concerning levels of lead, and Children's Hospital is with us in how that gets treated. It's a wonderful partnership. So yes, we're well. And I remember seeing Steve Harvey. This seems off subject, but I'm just trying to make a point here, Earl, was trying to help people understand how African Americans sometimes address things differently than the rest of the population in the United States. So he said, on the Titanic, there was the group that said, while it was sinking, you get your violin, you get your cello, we're going to play near my God today. And Steve Harvey said, the black people on that boat said, it's going down, grab any board, any table, anything that floats, let's get out of here. And I loved that. And I think, where is that conversation? Because the children and teenagers are being poisoned. They're being brain damaged. They will often be put in special needs classes for that reason. Where is that? Let's do something now about this. Where is that?
You know, sister, you're building. You just put a beautiful elevator in the building. It's five stories, okay? And you've got something in every story of that building that provides sustenance for people. And so you had the big cargo elevators, and it took, wow, I mean, you've got elevators now where people, you know, aren't cargo, and now they can feel. How important was that addition?
Yes, it's totally required. So now we are fulfilling the five-story stair tower that provides the additional exit, and we have the first few floors of the passenger elevator with guaranteed funding for that. And we have the 100-year-old freight elevator, but more exciting, I know you're excited. We have the plans for the full-scale commercial kitchen to begin construction beginning in March. And that will make it possible for us to have our meal program on site. And because food scarcity is the most alarming part of this area. And then third floor, after the kitchen is built, we have indoor gardens year round for third floor. We have the designs and the drawings, and we'll roll with that. And right now for second floor, we're in early conversations to have that be a medical clinic, that 7,000 square foot, the second floor. We're talking to some of the major providers, and it will happen.
You know, we talk about food deserts. Right across the street, you've created a wonderful garden where people can come and get vegetables, fresh vegetables. You put together a band stage. So there's an opportunity for people in that community for entertainment. I mean, you cover, Sister Brown, just all of the things that help make life beautiful, that have been out of the reach of the least of these, my people. That's what the sanctuary is. It brings hope, springs eternal. It's more than just words, right? People come.
I love hearing you say that, Earl.
True. I mean, I see it with my own eyes. I'm there, right? I spend time with you, and I spend time there. And whenever you call me, I'm there.
Yes.
Right?
Your support is just incredible, Earl. And just being on this show is because this is, as you know, a neighborhood where tragedy is normal, where when we bring people together for our different gatherings every week, and often the conversation is, who got shot last night?
Right.
Or which of us has a 27-year-old who had a stroke?
Right.
You know, it's you know, whose teenage grandson got arrested? And that's the normal, just incredibly, like people sitting at a coffee clutch at McDonald's, you know, this is what we talk about. We're trying to change that conversation. We're trying to have people have great things to talk about, exciting things, and have the reclaiming of human potential, which is so lost when you have a neighborhood that is like that kind of petri dish, so forsaken. You have a petri dish for all kinds of ugly, but now we have something very good happening there. And I'm so happy you allow that I can be on your program. And
well, listen,
be a duet
listen,
with
listen,
you,
this is,
a duet with you.
This is just the first time, because we have so much more ground to cover with the McCann & Brown Homeless Sanctuary, that we're going to do this again and again and again. Because I'll tell you, it's not just that area. It's many areas in Central City, Milwaukee, and Central Cities all over our nation.
Yeah.
The fact that the wealthiest nation on earth has people living like they do in Calcutta.
Yes.
I mean, there are people who won't believe the way people are living.
Yes.
Because they don't see it, out of sight, out of mind. But those are souls as well. And what you do, and why I love you so much, and what you and all those around you do, is not judge. Judge ye not, lest ye be judged. And we are full of judging people. We are so quick to judge. Well, they're drug addicts. Why are those people alcoholics and drug addicts? If you lived in the environment that these people live in, hopelessness, despair. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, year in, year out, decade in, decade out, and generationally, and nothing improves. And so that's what this is. And you are fighting against that, and you're winning. It's a tremendous battle.
Yeah.
But you know, you're a gnat taking on a beast. You're taking on an elephant.
David and Goliath.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? The gnat can sometimes win. The gnat can, you wonder how a gnat can defeat an elephant. Well, if enough gnats get together and get in the elephant's trunk, the gnat can defeat the elephant.
I love that.
And so if we get enough gnats, if we get enough McCann Browns, we're going to be successful. So I want to do this because this is the first of what I say is going to be many conversations with you and I as we spread the gospel according to my friend, Sister McCann Brown, to the winds. We're going to bring you back again and again and again and encourage people that, you know, you don't have to be Bill Gates. You can be an average person, right? And serve. I don't know. Do you have to have letters behind your name to serve, sister?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, some of the greatest people I know did not even finish high school. You know, there's something heroic in them. Their spirituality is beyond mine, you know. I see all the time what you're saying. But I do want to speak on your gift. You know, we spoke about my gift, but you have very special gifts, Earl. And you are able, you know, God is with you. You have your own ability to broadcast and share good news and to look closely at what's happening and what can we do about it. I just want to acknowledge that.
Well, thank you, sister. I'm just your average guy, and I know how to listen to He who created it all. And so, you know, you and I both have the discernment of listening. And so all of us have that ability if we'll just be quiet enough. My dear sister, we have to leave it there for now. But we will do this again soon, I promise you. And I'll be over in the coming weeks to sup with you. Because my spirit is always full when I'm around McCann Brown and her homeless sanctuary.
Thank you.